Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square, see you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and it's a very special edition of Who's Talking. We're doing this from the Cedars, our first off-site Who's Talking, and we're surrounded by a lot of the guests who've come from the Cedars to join us, and we're going to be interviewing some of the important people who live at the Cedars. All of them have great Chapel Hill connections, and the first one we're going to talk to is Ronnie Mann. Ronnie, welcome.
Thank you, and good afternoon, DG.
You've got a lot of friends who come out to see you perform on.
They like to see a grown man cry.
Who's Talking? I just say this. We've had the warmest welcome from both the residents and the staff at the Cedars, and is this the way you all are all the time?
Well, that's the way we experience this every day for the staff and residents, and that's a real good reason to be out here. Everybody gets along so well.
Well, you're here. I don't want to call the Cedars luxurious, but you could call it that, couldn't you?
Sure, you could.
Sure. And it's quite different from your experience growing up.
Oh, yes.
Carrboro.
Oh, yes. I was born in a mill house in downtown Carrboro in 1934, and there was one paved street in Carrboro at that time, and we had one school system. Carrboro was part of the Chapel Hill school system, so after elementary school, went to Chapel Hill High School, and then UNC.
Well, when you go from the Cedars and drive down to downtown Carrboro, tell us about what you think about when you see the changes in what's happened in this community.
Well, it's just so happened, not as part of this program, but last night my wife and I dragged Maine, as we say, and we went down Franklin Street and went all the way through Carrboro and turned around and came back, and neither Chapel Hill nor Carrboro are the places that I grew up. It's gentrified, all the high-rise apartments and condominiums and new stores. It's just the growth has been phenomenal and the change has been phenomenal.
Well, now you grew up when it was the Mill Village. Now, you miss the Mill Village, and would you like for it to be like it was? Or do you say, oh, this is great that they're rich people living in a $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 house that would have cost $10,000 when you were growing up?
Well, that was then, and this is now. Back when we grew up, everybody was sort of in the same situation, except for the professors. Most in Carrboro, the people who worked at the university lived there. The professors lived in Chapel Hill, and so there was a distinct difference of the two towns. That has changed over the years, and there are a lot of professors. There are a lot of new developments in and around Carrboro, and certainly things are more expensive, and as I say earlier, Carrboro has become more gentrified. I think I saw a place in Carrboro that was on the market for $500,000 that I think when I grew up was probably $5,000.
That's amazing. Now, did you grow up poor?
Not really. Daddy was a builder. We were no better off financially or any other way than any other people, but Daddy worked. He had a building business, and Mother stayed home and looked after four children.
Wow. Now, tell us about starting to work for Fitch Lumber.
Okay. After I finished school here at Carolina in 59, I was actually class of 57, I went to work for my father in the building business, and Fitch was experiencing a lot of growth at that time. And so they approached my father and asked, would it be all right to talk to me about coming to work there? So I started there in 1962 and worked till 98 when I retired. And of course, Fitch is a local institution too. And it's been, they were very good to me or I would not be out here. And seen a lot of growth personally, and Fitch Lumber Company was just a little ramshackle building until 1968 when they built their current building, and they allied themselves with Ace Hardware and another buying concern, which helped them tremendously, and they started catering to the better builders and more custom mill work, and so that was our niche and still is.
It seems to me when I look for places in Carver and Chapel Hill that I can go that are like the places that I would go to when I was growing up, mm-hmm. the sort of the general store and the personal service that Fitch retains that maybe as well as any of the other businesses in Chapel Hill.
I think that R.B. Fitch Jr. and Mac Fitch, who is the current owner and manager, have tried to keep it that way, keep it a small town enterprise, even though it's grown considerably over the years.
Tell us what you did in this long career at Fitch.
Well, I started out as an outside salesman, and then I became the paint manager, and my son thought that was the most marvelous thing in the world that I'd come home and talk about mixing paint. And and he loved to find out about all the nails that I sold. And well, I worked there for, as I say, for about 38 years, and worked my way up, and I was the general manager for the last 15 to 20 years I was there. And
what did the outside salesman do, and what does the outside sales people force
well,
do today?
They, as the name implies, they're outside the store most of the time. They're calling on builders, subcontractors, trying to compete with other retailers and sell merchandise and get them to buy stuff from Fitch Lumber Company.
Well, we think of them as a place to walk in and buy something.
True.
And so you're not going to be calling on me because I'm not a regular buyer. Who are you calling on, and what do you tell them?
Well, we would call on what we thought were the better builders in Chapel Hill, people who built better houses than just the tract houses. Nothing wrong with tract houses, but we felt like that we were having to compete with Lowe's and the other boxes who money or the pricing was all they were able to sell. We were trying to sell a quality merchandise.
Well, what would you tell them? What would you do for them that would make you distinguish you from your competitors?
Well, it's not an instantaneous thing. It's built upon communication and faith. You have to work a client, as you well know, because everybody has got something to sell, and if price is all you're selling, then you're going to be washed away by the first breeze that comes by.
Well, let's talk about characters.
All right.
And you've got some characters out here who are your friends that we might talk about some other time.
Okay.
But for them and for other folks who are listening, as we're doing, we're here at the Cedars, but folks from all over Chapel Hill are listening to us. And I say, Ronnie, tell us about some of the characters in Carver and Chapel Hill when you were a little boy and when you were young. Was anybody you were afraid of, anybody you really looked up to, anybody you could tell us a story about?
Well, Carver had a town manager, and I truly cannot think of his name now, but he sort of ran the town until Mr. C.T. Ellington, who also worked at Fitch Lumber Company, Charlie Ellington, became the mayor of Carver and ran unopposed for, I think, 20 years. And he finally had an opponent, and his opponent got four votes, and Charlie got the rest of them, and the town council was thinking about giving this man a gun permit, because if he didn't have any more friends than that, he better not walk down the streets of Carver.
Well, we've just experienced an election where some folks found out they didn't have nearly as many friends as they thought.
Right.
I hope there are not any gun permits being issued. Well, now we just got a minute or two more. How about at the Cedars? Now, I don't want to put you on the spot because you made many new friends. And if you had to pick an example of somebody that you've met here at the Cedars that you wish that more people in Chapel Hill knew.
Golly, Pete, that's hard to narrow that down to than 400, actually.
Now, we won't accuse you. We'll pick out somebody at random.
Well, let's see. I'll just look on the first row to Harvey Gunter, a dear friend of ours. We had known of Harvey, and as soon as we moved out here, Christy, my wife, and I were invited over to Harvey's for cocktails one evening, and I think we clicked, and Christy and Harvey and I have become very good friends, and Harvey is I think, a perfect example of the people who live out here. It's the Cedars are very nice, gets along with everybody, willing to help.
All right, we got to cut that off. That's just too much about Harvey. He's my friend, too.
I don't owe him any money either.
I know, and we're out of time. But Ronnie, man, you grew up, you and your wife, Christy, grew up here, and thanks for sharing both the tales of Old Carver and Old Chapel Hill, Fitch Lumber Company, and your happiness about being here at the Cedars. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with another guest from the Cedars.
Okay, thank you.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking, or welcome back to Who's Talking. We're doing a great program right here at the Cedars in Chapel Hill, right on the borderline between Orange and Durham County. And it's great to be on either side of that line when you're in the Cedars. Jane Hauser is the daughter of a football coach. And so, Jane, you're a resident at the Cedars now. Did you grow up in Chapel Hill, or were you just here for a short time while your dad was a coach here?
Well, being a football coach's daughter, I say, means that we never owned a house, but we always had a big, fast car to get out of town. So we got out of Nashville, Tennessee, where my dad had been the coach at Vanderbilt, and came to Carolina, to Chapel Hill, when George Barkley was the head coach back in the early 50s. And, he got out of town again.
Well, now it's always interesting to me because I've, had these overlapping experiences with wonderful athletic coaches when I was growing up in Davidson. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my best friends had to leave town because the team lost a game or something like that, and it just happened that way. But what was it like for the football kids to pack up and leave and make friends? And then I guess the thing that always I wondered about was it's just like being the child of a politician where the focus of the media is on you and you get criticized if the team doesn't perform. And then you hear your daddy being,
right,
saying, oh, he didn't call the right play, or
right,
something like that.
Well, first of all, I've moved 35 times. And part of that was because I was a coach's daughter. I was in the ninth grade before I finished in the same school I started.
Do you remember
where that was? I think it was Nashville. Maybe it was Ohio. I don't know. I've gotten some ugly phone calls from alums, when I was a little girl growing up, but we were like, I think probably politicians' families are. I mean, we were a tight family, and there was a lot of love and fun in my family, so I didn't really notice it until I got older.
So you were able to bounce, your family gave you the strength to say, if somebody wants to call about and say something bad about my daddy, well, that's just that person's problem. Or did you cry? Or what was? How did you handle these things?
I think I probably got angry a little, or I just ignored it. I mean, it was somebody drunk. It was somebody ignorant.
Well, there's another profession. Well, tell us how you met your husband. Tell us. Is that a Chapel Hill story?
Yes, I do. I went to school at UNC. I came because my father was coaching here, and he left before I graduated, but I stayed on. I love Chapel Hill. And I ran for secretary of the student body, and I lost, to a beautiful blonde, leggy nurse. And in the local paper, the Chapel Hill Weekly, a columnist wrote, well, it appears that Carolina gentlemen really do prefer blondes.
Oh, come on now.
Well, that's what I thought. And I said, if I ever meet this guy, I'm going to make his life miserable. And I did. I married him.
That was the supreme penalty, right, for saying something.
I met Chuck about a year later.
And he was the editor of the Tar Heel.
He'd been an editor of the Tar Heel. At that time, he was working. He was out. He had graduated.
And he was working for the Chapel Hill paper.
Working for the Chapel Hill paper.
Wow.
And when we moved back here, he came full circle. He had a column for the Chapel Hill Weekly. So
that's an incredible story. Now, when you all were talking about that article that he wrote about your losing the election, what was that, a painful kind of thing, or did you just laugh?
No, it's a good story.
What did you? How did he defend himself? Even when you were teasing him about it,
I don't know. We got past that.
Well, now, how about your life after marrying this awful newspaper man who wrote that bad story about this blonde that gentlemen prefer?
Well, of course, as a coach's daughter, I've been raised to not believe what I read in the newspaper. So, and I had to teach my mother not to throw away the big stack of newspapers around our house when she came to visit me. Because those were files.
Right.
So we had a great time. We moved to London and Paris and Washington, D.C., and we had a good time.
Did he stay in the newspaper business?
Oh, yes, all his life.
What were some of the assignments that he had?
Well, he was in Charlotte and also in Greensboro Daily News. He was the managing editor there. And we finished up the last 18 years in Providence, Rhode Island. And he was the editor of the Providence Journal Bulletin.
Well,
it was a great place to be a newspaper man because Chuck said there were three really corrupt states in the U.S., and Rhode Island was one of them. So it was great.
That's great. Well, since you've been here, you've... what's the right way to you've taken up a new enterprise?
I have. My husband died 5.5 years ago, and the people at the Cedars really saw me through on this. They were great, and the community comes together when one of us is in pain. And I decided that either I would stay in my bathrobe and watch television, or I would do something that Chuck had encouraged me to do for years, but I hadn't had to risk it, and that was to tell stories. So I became a professional storyteller.
Well, you know, I have no... how am I going to say this? I admire people who can tell a story and who know how to pick the points, how to not just ramble on. Well, I certainly don't know how not to ramble on. But what are the ingredients of... what have you learned of the important lessons about how to tell a good story that you could share with us? We'll never be like you are, but we might not bore our friends quite as much if we know better how to tell a story.
Folks around here might be familiar with Donald Davis, who always tells every December out at the barn at Farrington. And all you have to do is bring a canned goods to hear him, and he is spectacular. He tells stories about growing up in Appalachia. And I took a retreat under him when I first started. And what he said was, you start out and you tell about how the world is, or the town, or the family, or whatever it is you're telling about. And then something happens, and the world changes. And you've got to have at the end what makes a difference. Something has happened, and things are no longer the way they were when you started that story 10 minutes ago.
Well.
So I learned the difference between an anecdote, which is what I told you about Jerry Schneider, who won the election, the blonde.
Remember her name, too.
She lives here. It's Jerry Laporte. I met her. In fact, a friend of mine here said, I'd like to invite my neighbor over. Can they have a glass of wine at your house? I said, sure. What's her name? He said, Jerry Schneider Laporte. I said, oh, no.
So, well, if that's not a story, but it's an anecdote, it's right. One of the best I've ever heard.
Good.
Almost as good as a story. And I want to come back sometime and have you give me even more instructions about how to tell a good story. And we're telling us these stories from the Cedars here in Chapel Hill. We'll be back after this short break so that you can meet another one of the great residents here.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking, or welcome back to Who's Talking. We're doing a great program right here at the Cedars in Chapel Hill, right on the borderline between Orange and Durham County. And it's great to be on either side of that line when you're in the Cedars. Jane Hauser is the daughter of a football coach. And so, Jane, you're a resident at the Cedars now. Did you grow up in Chapel Hill, or were you just here for a short time while your dad was a coach here?
Well, being a football coach's daughter, I say, means that we never owned a house, but we always had a big, fast car to get out of town. So we got out of Nashville, Tennessee, where my dad had been the coach at Vanderbilt, and came to Carolina, to Chapel Hill, when George Barkley was the head coach back in the early 50s. And, he got out of town again.
Well, now how that's, you know, it's always interesting to me because I've had these overlapping experiences with wonderful athletic coaches when I was growing up in Davidson. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my best friends had to leave town because the team lost a game or something like that, and it just happened that way. But what was it like for the football kids to pack up and leave and make friends? And then I guess the thing that always I wondered about was it's just like being the child of a politician where the focus of the media is on you and you get criticized if the team doesn't perform. And then you hear your daddy being, saying, oh, he didn't call the right play or something like that.
Well, first of all, I've moved 35 times. And part of that was because I was a coach's daughter. I was in the ninth grade before I finished in the same school I started.
Where?
I don't even remember where that was. I think it was Nashville. Maybe it was Ohio. I don't know. I've gotten some ugly phone calls from alums when I was a little girl growing up. But we were like, I think, probably politicians' families are. I mean, we were a tight family. And there was a lot of love and fun in my family. So I didn't really notice it until I got older.
So you were able to bounce. Your family gave you the strength to say, if somebody wants to call about and say something bad about my daddy, well, that's just that person's problem. Or did you cry? Or what was? How did you handle these things?
I think I probably got angry a little, or I just ignored it. I mean, it was somebody drunk. It was somebody ignorant.
Well, there's another profession. Well, tell us how you met your husband. Tell us, is that a Chapel Hill story?
Yes, I do. I went to school at UNC. I came because my father was coaching here, and he left before I graduated, but I stayed on. I love Chapel Hill. And I ran for a secretary of the student body, and I lost, to a beautiful blonde, leggy nurse. And in the local paper, the Chapel Hill Weekly, a columnist wrote, well, it appears that Carolina gentlemen really do prefer blondes.
Oh, come on now.
Well, that's what I thought. And I said, if I ever meet this guy, I'm going to make his life miserable. And I did. I married him.
That was the supreme penalty, right, for saying something.
I met Chuck about a year later.
And he was the editor of the Tar Heel.
He'd been an editor of the Tar Heel. At that time, he was working. He was out. He had graduated
And he was working for the Chapel Hill paper.
Working for the Chapel Hill paper.
Wow.
And when we moved back here, he came full circle. He had a column for the Chapel Hill Weekly. So
that's an incredible story. Now, when you all were talking about that article that he wrote about your losing the election, what was that, a painful kind of thing, or did you just laugh?
No, it's a good story.
How did he defend himself? Even when you were teasing him about it,
I don't know. We got past that.
Well, now, how about your life after marrying this awful newspaper man who wrote that bad story about this blonde that gentlemen prefer?
Well, of course, as a coach's daughter, I've been raised to not believe what I read in the newspaper. So, and I had to teach my mother not to throw away the big stack of newspapers around our house when she came to visit me. Because those were files.
Right.
So we had a great time. We moved to London and Paris and Washington, D.C., and we had a good time.
Did he stay in the newspaper business?
Oh, yes, all his life.
What were some of the assignments that he had?
Well, he was in Charlotte and also in Greensboro Daily News. He was the managing editor there. And we finished up the last 18 years in Providence, Rhode Island. And he was the editor of the Providence Journal Bulletin.
Well,
it was a great place to be a newspaper man because Chuck said there were three really corrupt states in the U.S., and Rhode Island was one of them. So it was great.
That's great. Well, since you've been here, you've... what's the right way to you've taken up a new enterprise?
I have. My husband died 5.5 years ago, and the people at the Cedars really saw me through on this. They were great, and the community comes together when one of us is in pain. And I decided that either I would stay in my bathrobe and watch television, or I would do something that Chuck had encouraged me to do for years, but I hadn't had to risk it, and that was to tell stories. So I became a professional storyteller.
Well, you know, I have no... how am I going to say this? I admire people who can tell a story and who know how to pick the points, how to not just ramble on. Well, I certainly don't know how not to ramble on. But what are the ingredients of... what have you learned of the important lessons about how to tell a good story that you could share with us? We'll never be like you are, but we might not bore our friends quite as much if we know better how to tell a story.
Folks around here might be familiar with Donald Davis, who always tells every December out at the barn at Farrington. And all you have to do is bring a canned goods to hear him, and he is spectacular. He tells stories about growing up in Appalachia. And I took a retreat under him when I first started. And what he said was, you start out and you tell about how the world is, or the town, or the family, or whatever it is you're telling about. And then something happens, and the world changes, and you've got to have at the end what makes a difference. Something has happened, and things are no longer the way they were when you started that story 10 minutes ago.
Well,
so I learned the difference between an anecdote, which is what I told you about Jerry Schneider, who won the election, the blonde.
Remember her name, too.
She lives here. It's Jerry Laporte. I met her. In fact, a friend of mine here said, I'd like to invite my neighbor over. Could they have a glass of wine at your house? I said, sure. What's her name? He said, Jerry Schneider Laporte. I said, oh, no.
So, well, if that's not a story, but it's an anecdote, it's
right.
One of the best I've ever heard.
Good.
Almost as good as a story. And I want to come back sometime and have you give me even more instructions
All right.
about how to tell a good story. And we're telling us these stories from the Cedars here in Chapel Hill. We'll be back after this short break so that you can meet another one of the great residents here.
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square, see you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. We're recording our program here at the Cedars in Chapel Hill, having a great time. We've gotten a very warm welcome from all of the residents, and now I have to confess that the real reason that I wanted to come down and visit the residents of the Cedars is that I've been working for 5 years to get Raleigh Tillman to be my guest on Who's Talking, and the only way I could get Raleigh Tillman on my radio program was to come to the Cedars because of one thing or another. But you're here.
Yea, verily.
I suppose that if anybody is better known among the Chapel Hill Carborough community as a resident of the Cedars, I don't know about it. You've been here since 1951. That would be almost
a long time.
60 years.
That's right.
At Chapel Hill.
Almost.
But you didn't grow up in North Carolina. What brought you from Florida to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill?
I grew up in a very, very small town of, 6,000 people in the summer and 9,000 in the winter. We picked two money crops a year, oranges and Yankees. And there were 62 people in my high school class. And a cousin of mine had ventured forth, came from a large bunch of cousins, had ventured forth to Chapel Hill. And he was a good salesman. And my sister changed from Florida State University and came up here for her senior year, and I never applied anywhere else. This was before the days of SAT scores, thank God. I wrote an application, and Roy Armstrong said, y'all come, and I did. And it changed my life.
In what way?
Well, I grew up in a town of, 6,000 people. Chapel Hill.
And you came to the metropolis of Chapel Hill.
Chapel Hill only had 6,000 people, too, in the town. And 5,000 in the student body. It had just gotten back to 5,000 from the surge after World War II. So things were going a little bit. Victory Village was still there. But it was basically a wonderful small town. And I was enchanted looking forward to my first snowflake. And just sort of captured by fall. I'd never seen autumn. And I can remember walking down Cameron Avenue with these gorgeous leaves, and I was picking them up and mailing them home, and people probably thought I was crazy, which was probably a good definition of what I was. And then finally we had snow, and then spring just blew my mind, and I sort of knew I might never make it back to Florida.
Well, it's such a beautiful story for me because the autumn, which is almost on us here at Chapel Hill, and the incredible beauty of the town and those leaves, every one of them is precious, except that they're always there. We always see them. But when you see them for the first time, it's
Florida's just different kind of green year-round. I've been swimming in the lake on Christmas Day and was just not used to that kind of seasonality.
When you got here and started thinking about your future profession, did you know from the very beginning that teaching people in the business school would be something?
Oh, heavens no. No, I thought I majored in business because I thought I might go to law school. And then I got entranced with advertising and marketing in the business school and thought I'd have a career there. And the more I thought about it, the more I got to thinking about, you didn't really do that. You'd have to leave Chapel Hill, and that was not too attractive, particularly since my senior year, I met someone in the junior class that I was quite taken with, and we lived together for almost 50 years.
Did you ever get married?
Oh, yes. You're a very modern person. It was mostly unthinkable in my day that we wouldn't. Yeah. We did that in due proper course.
Well, you have the reputation of being one of the most extraordinarily inspiring and gifted teachers in the business school. And I always wondered whether it was because you knew how that marketing and changing people's minds and figuring out how to do that is, that you don't have to, I mean, that you just tell those stories and they work for themselves. Did you have to work real hard to develop the kind of inspiring classroom presentations that people still talk about?
I think practice helps. The fact that you do it for 44 years gives you a little leg up. But you must understand that the great teachers of the university were lecturers for the most part, the ones we remember. Business is not taught that way. Business is taught with case method and discussion and tweaking their ideas and making them see both sides of it. So if I had any skill, it was making sure that everyone in the class sort of got involved in the discussion. And together we learned things. Now, every now and then I'd have to break down and give a little lecture, but by popular demand, they preferred that I give the other kind of talk.
That they taught themselves,
yes.
Or that you guided them in teaching themselves. Nevertheless, I'm fascinated, and I think most of us are fascinated in what it takes to make us make decisions of one sort or another. That was what you were teaching in large part these folks in the business school.
Sure.
What are the basics, and have they changed over the years with the change in technology, television?
Oh, it doesn't change much more than every 6 hours in a modern economy, because there's going to be new technology, new products, new communications, new owners. It's a constantly changing thing.
Are there some basics, though, that are fundamental that stay the same?
At least from my perspective of marketing, is that you understand what your customers need, and you try to design products or services that do that better than anyone else, and then you try to communicate it to them. Now it's done with computers and websites and things that didn't. Listen, every now and then I'll give a slideshow and I'll click on something and see it change letters. And I tell people that the reason I do that is to prove I can, because I can remember when the dean authorized us to have colored chalk so that we could make powerful things on the blackboard with our audio-visual technique there.
Well, you heard earlier Raleigh Mann talk a little bit about being the outside salesman. And are there marketing lessons to be learned from those people who go and visit their customers and listen?
And Ronnie told you what makes a good one. He understands and empathizes with the customer, and he shows him how if you deal with us, we're both going to be very happy about it. He makes friends, and he understands their needs because his dad was a builder. He's probably a terrific outdoor salesman because he had lived and grown with that business, and he knew what made for a good relationship between supplier and buyer.
Well, what could Ronnie teach your classmates who are going to be operating not in the person-to-person world but in the world of tech, high-tech, newspaper advertising, television advertising?
He could teach people that you didn't necessarily – that making the sale wasn't the most dominant thing. If your product didn't really suit them, Ronnie would probably tell them, no, but we can tell you where to get it.
Someplace else.
He was customer-oriented, and I'm just betting on that because he's a relentlessly honest guy, which I admire.
I want to ask you one other thing that I've been dying to ask you, and we don't have enough time for you to give an answer in full. But you know this campus. You love this campus.
I do love this campus.
And there, you have people who are here at the Cedars and folks who are listening to our station and this program who would love for you to tell us a couple of your favorite spots on the campus.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I like to stand in the middle of it where the trustees met and decided to put the university here. And I think that's every time I walk by that, I think about it. And there was no Chapel Hill. There was a chapel on the hill, but it had fallen bad ways after the Revolutionary War. It was an Anglican chapel. And there were these two Indian paths that sort of crossed here. And right where they crossed is where the Crossroads Cafe is now at the Carolina Inn.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's the reason of that name. So I think that's one place I never get over. I like the view from the overview at Gemgul. That's a special place. The trees have grown up a lot now, but you used to be able to see all the way to the airport practically on that. And I'm just a sucker for Chapel Hill. I like to wander when the bell tower is ringing. I like to, you know, I don't have any favorite place. This whole place is where I really have lived my life. And someone said, "You lived in Chapel Hill all your life?" And I said, "Not yet." But I can tell you where it's going to end.
Well, you are one of those institutions of Chapel Hill, and when we talk about the great characters, you're on that list, and it's because you're always doing what you've done for us today, and that is to share yourself and to share your ideas. And
you're kind.
And
it's easy to be a good teacher in Chapel Hill because the students are so wonderful. And it's almost like medicine. First, do no harm. and if you can teach them that, you've done a good deal.
Well, I wish we weren't out of time, Raleigh Tillman. We thank you for sharing, and we thank everyone at the Cedars, both our guests and also the people who were good enough to come and listen to us talk. Thanks to all those other folks who listened on this special edition of Who's Talking, brought to you right here at the Cedars. Tune in again. This is D.G. Martin with Who's Talking, and I'll be right back here soon.